You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Director, actor, writer, raconteur Peter Bogdanovich died on January 6, 2022, at the age of 82. His many films as director include The Last Picture Show, Paper Moon, What's Up, Doc, and Mask. He acted in film and on television, including a recurring role on The Sopranos. He wrote books about film and a memoir. He was a film historian whose friends included John Ford, Orson Welles, and Quentin Tarantino. This week, From the Bookshelf presents a conversation with Peter Bogdanovich that I recorded back in April of 2009. I began our conversation by asking how a man who can write, act, direct, and do impressions decides what project to embark upon next.
Well, my main gig is directing, writing and directing movies. And when there isn't a movie or there's a pause between movies, I do something else. Or I sometimes do them concurrently. But it's, you know, in show business, unless you're a Spielberg, I guess, you go where the wind blows a little bit. So I've been a bit of a cork in the river. I think it was Renoir, Jean Renoir, said his father, the painter, said you have to be a cork in the river, but a smart cork.
Well, you do fine impressions. Is that something you could always do when you were a kid?
Yeah, I was famous for my Bugs Bunny impression in kindergarten and grade school. So everybody called me Bugs. My nickname for until I finished high school was Bugs.
You know, a lot of people made a living doing impressions. Did you ever think of doing a nightclub act and doing?
No, the closest I got to it was I auditioned for CBS at one point and did a monologue, which was not very funny. At least they didn't laugh. I was very young. I was a teenager.
You started your career as an actor.
Yeah, I started as an actor, was studying, well, at the American Academy of Dramatic Art in the teenage classes on Saturday morning. And that got me a job as an apprentice in Michigan on a summer season of summer theater. And then I started studying with Stella Adler, and for 4 years I studied with her for four full years, took all her courses. That was amazing.
Did you meet Marlon Brando when he was there?
No, I met Marlon Brando on my own by accident a couple of times, but I did share Stella with Marlon. We talked about her a few times.
Yeah.
At some point, like at the time I was about 19, decided I wanted to direct in the theater, and that's the first thing I directed was in the 59-60 season. I was 20. I did a production of Clifford Odets' The Big Knife.
That was off-Broadway?
Yeah.
So theater directing, was that, you know, preceded your desire to direct films?
No, I think it was an attempt to, I hoped I'd be discovered as a brilliant theater director and that they'd hustle me off into movies. Didn't work out that way. Yeah. Best laid plans. I actually got into movies because Roger Corman recognized my name from having written a few pieces for Esquire, and said, "You're a writer," and I said, "Yeah, would you like to write a movie?" And then that's how I got to work on The Wild Angels, which is the first film I worked on.
You were one of the writers on that picture?
I rewrote the whole script.
Uh-huh.
Got no credit and got $300.
$300 was a lot of money?
No. But Roger remembered that I'd done a lot of work on it, and I became his assistant on the picture and ended up directing the second unit. And he was impressed with what I did, so he gave me the opportunity to direct my own first picture, Targets, with Boris Karloff.
Well, so what was that like to work with Karloff? I mean, you must have admired his work since he had been in the pictures.
Well,
he'd
been in a lot of pictures, and he was a lovely man. He was a real pro. He was 79, and he had emphysema and braces on both legs, but he couldn't, You couldn't stop a trooper. I only worked with him 5 days, but that's all we had him for.
Really?
Yeah.
How long did you spend on the picture?
23.
Oh, I see. So you worked around him the rest of the time.
Well, we shot all his stuff in 5 days somehow.
How did that lead to the last picture show?
The producers of the last picture show, Bert Schneider and Bob Rafelson and Steve Blauner, BBS, saw Targets, and I had a meeting with them, and they said they'd like to do anything I'd be interested in doing, I should bring to them. They were impressed with Targets, so I sent them the novel of the last picture show, and they said, yeah, let's do it, and it was very simple, that was it. They just had to get the rights from somebody else, and they did, and we made it.
Yeah, you used a lot of unknown actors, or inexperienced actors, I guess, in the last picture show. What were the advantages of that over, say, movie stars in the picture?
Well, first of all, we couldn't afford movie stars, but even if we could, the plan was a very inexpensive picture. It only cost $1.3 million, and I was $300,000 over budget. So it was supposed to be a $1 million picture. But the whole idea was to use new people and make that kind of movie where you use an unknown cast, essentially. And that was always the plan. We never thought about using stars. We did think about it. There was a talk about Jimmy Stewart playing the Sam the Lion part. There was talk about Vera Miles playing playing Sybil's mother.
Mm-hmm.
But at a certain point, I decided that having one star would throw the whole thing off. So we decided to have no stars. The closest we got to a star was Ben Johnson, who
was a co-star.
He was not a star, but he was a somewhat familiar character actor.
If you'd seen a lot of Westerns, then you knew who he was.
Yeah.
Was there any objection to you making that picture in black and white?
I thought there would be, but there wasn't. I proposed to the producers that we do it in black and white, and Bert Schneider said, why? And I said, well, I think that the period is going to be much easier to capture and convey in black and white. And then I think, as Orson Welles said, black and white helps actors to give better performances.
Why do you think that's so?
Well, Orson used to say it was the actor's friend. Because every performance, he said, looks better in black and white. He went on to say, name me a great performance in color, I defy you. But I don't know why it is, but it is true. It seems to ground the performance and makes it more real. I don't know, because black and white is an abstraction, but it seems to make it more real.
Mm-hmm.
I guess because you remove the distractions like hair color, eye color, skin color. You just focus on you can't be distracted by irrelevant things like what color the eyes are or something like that.
I might be wrong, but I think that The Last Picture Show was one of the first films to use existing music rather than a score. Was that your decision to use records?
Was that my decision? Yeah. I had done the same thing in a much less elaborate way in my first picture in Targets. We couldn't afford a score or records. But I had a friend who had produced some records, and he gave me 5 45s and said, you can use anything you want on there. It costs us $5,000. And that was where the idea came to use music as a sound effect rather than as music. And so that's what I did in Targets. And then when I came to Last Picture Show, I had liked the way it kind of creates another world, creates a kind of complexity to the scene, particularly if the music is counterpoint to the scene itself. In other words, instead of scoring the scene, you kind of do the music, you use the music as a kind of counterpoint to create another world that's going on within the scene. I think the most drastic use of that was at the end of The Last Picture Show, where there's this very emotional scene between Cloris Leachman and Tim Bottoms, and She throws the coffee and yells at him, and then they make up. And in the background, you hear this very corny comedy record.
Right.
With the people laughing and stupid music and so on. That was an extreme example of what I'm talking about.
We're talking with Peter Bogdanovich. We just recently watched the Last Picture Show at the together at the Golden State Festival Film Festival in Monterey. Is that the same film that people saw in 1971? How is that film different than it was then?
It's coming out on DVD again in a cleaned up print at the end of this month. It's different by about 6 minutes.
You've tinkered with it some?
I added 6 minutes to it that I always felt was needed.
Uh-huh.
And we cleaned up the sound and cleaned up the picture, but it's essentially the same movie. It's just 6 minutes longer.
Have you cut anything?
No.
What do you think about that? Do you think that's a good idea? I mean, obviously you do, because you did it, but I mean, do you think directors should tinker with their movies?
Well, I think if you've been bothered by something and you have a chance to fix it, yeah. I mean, my father was a painter, and he used to say, no painting is ever finished.
Uh-huh.
And Robert Graves had the same thought, who said, no poem is ever perfect. So, I think no picture is ever perfect or finished in a way. But when you do the best you can and you don't have any interference and you finish it the way you want to, you might be able to do it better, but there's nothing more you can do.
Yeah.
I had that experience with a number of pictures where maybe I could do it better, but I can't do it in this lifetime I can't.
Right, right. You did the best you could.
So Paper Moon and What's Up Doc and Targets and Daisy Miller. And
when you see them now, you think, oh, I wish I could do this.
No, I don't really. It'd be pointless.
Mm-hmm.
Either you leave it alone or you want to redo the whole thing. But other pictures where you feel that you've compromised or it wasn't exactly the way you wanted it or whatever, then I'm very happy to go back. Or pictures where the scenes have been cut, like Mask, for example.
Oh, right.
I added 8 minutes and put the Springsteen music back that had been taken out, and I timed the color correctly, that it had been mistimed by way too bright.
So people who see Mask on DVD will see a true
version.
They'll
see the version that I intended 20 years ago and didn't succeed in having it done.
So
that was a big one to fix.
Did you have more freedom on the Last Picture Show than any other picture that you made?
No. No, I didn't have a lot. I mean, I had freedom.
Uh-huh.
But I always argued with them about it. I thought it was too short when it came out. I thought we were about 6 minutes too short.
Uh-huh.
And
so you've added 6 minutes.
I went added 6 minutes when I was allowed to, when I finally could do it. No, I had more freedom on Doc and Paper Moon and
uh-huh.
Daisy Miller, St. Jack. They all laughed. Those were completely autonomous.
You also collaborated with Larry McMurtry, correct me if I'm wrong, but on a treatment for Lonesome Dove, that was going to be a film that you were going to do?
No, that was the film that we were going to do. It wasn't a treatment, it was a screenplay.
Oh, uh-huh, so you actually had a screenplay?
Oh, full-length screenplay, yeah.
Who was going to be in it?
It was written for John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart, Henry Fonda, Ben Johnson, Sybil Shepherd, Cloris Leachman, Ellen Burstyn, Ben Johnson, I said.
What happened?
It was a huge picture.
Why didn't we get it?
Larry and I worked on it together for a few months, and he would write pages, and then I would cut them down or make them more into screenplay form and edit. But he wrote a 350-page screenplay, which I cut down to about 150 pages. And Duke Wayne turned it down. Jimmy Stewart said okay, Fonda said okay, but Duke didn't want to do it. And it's kind of an end of the West Western, Pete, and I'm not ready to hang up my spurs yet. But you don't die in it. No, but everybody else does.
So Duke was going to be which character then? Call?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that would have been a great movie.
It would have been a great movie, yeah. The person who told him to turn it down was John Ford.
Why did he tell him to turn it down?
Well, he didn't want him to do it with me. It was too much. He was on his deathbed, and I mean, he helped me get Ben Johnson, but he wasn't going to give me Duke Wayne.
That was his guy.
That was his guy. He wasn't going to give me on his deathbed. He wasn't going to give John Wayne to some goddamn slob.
Could you have gotten Glenn Ford or somebody to do it?
I didn't want to do it with anybody else. I said, if we can't get John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart, and Henry Fonda, I don't want to do it. And I said to Larry, why don't you write it as a novel? And 13 years later, he did and won the Pulitzer Prize.
It's a wonderful story.
Well, yeah, it started out as a Western for me. I got Warners to pay him some money to write an original, and we started. We worked out the story and who was going to be in it and what was going to happen, and he started writing. Wonderful stuff, and then I would rewrite it and send it back to him, and we worked like that until we got a script. And then he eventually went back to Warners and bought it back from Warners and wrote the novel.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. And this week we are listening back to my 2009 interview with film director Peter Bogdanovich. His movies included The Last Picture Show, Paper Moon, and What's Up, Doc?
Speaking of the, we're talking about director's cuts of the movies and so forth. What did you think of someone else recutting Touch of Evil?
Well, I'm the one who found that memo.
Mm-hmm.
Charlton Heston gave it to me when I was preparing a book on Orson, which came out
92.
Called This Is Orson Welles. And I thought it was an interesting idea. They didn't do it very well. I thought they made a few mistakes. Unfortunately, there was no filmmaker involved. They didn't even tell me they were doing it because they didn't want me to get any credit for it.
I see. They didn't.
Academics tend to be even more greedy than regular people. I thought it was. I didn't think they did it right. The opening without the music was a mistake. But they did. It was okay.
In the audio commentary that you did on Citizen Kane, you said that you didn't think Kane was Welles' best picture. What do you think is Welles' best picture?
Well, I mean, it's certainly a great film, and I don't mean to denigrate it. It's just I think there was never a confluence of all those elements that make it that where Orson had complete control, and he never had that as much, plus all the technical apparatus at his disposal again. He thought Chimes of Midnight was his best film, and it's a great film. It's hard to argue that Kane isn't his best film, because the rest of them are so hard to see.
Yeah.
But Othello's pretty great, and Chimes of Midnight, and I love Touch of Evil.
Well, in
Amberson's, I think, probably would have been a greater film if it had been his version.
If he'd gotten a chance.
As it is, the first hour is extraordinary.
You also mentioned how much radio influenced his filmmaking. You were a fan of radio also when you were growing up?
Yeah, well, radio was dying as I was growing up. As I reached my teens, radio was over, pretty much. But I was privileged to hear dramatic radio and comedy radio, you know, when I was about 6, 7, until I was about 10.
And you saw...
I loved radio.
And you saw a ton of movies. You loved the movies, of course.
Yeah, well, but radio was my first love, as it was Orson's.
Uh-huh.
I think theater was his first love, but he loved radio, and he did. I would say one of the sad things about our culture is that it's so disposable, and Orson Welles did some of his greatest work in radio, and nobody's ever heard it. And it's extraordinary. It should be available, but nobody'd be interested, but it is amazing work. It's as great as some of his movies, some of the radio he did.
Before and after War of the Worlds, I guess that's the one that
everybody heard. Yeah, he always used to, I asked him about War of the Worlds, well, we always used to think that was one of our lesser shows.
Well, in the
and it was. I mean, what he did with the apple tree, Galt with the apple tree, or Oscar Wilde's The Happy Prince, or those are two that come to mind that are amazing.
When he did the War of the Worlds, he knew exactly what he was doing, right?
Oh, sure.
You know,
he had ripped off the idea from a Spanish radio show, the idea of simulating newscasts.
Mm-hmm.
And as he put it, the guy in Spain went to jail I didn't go to jail. I went to Hollywood. And he, you know, I mean, that show was a sensation. Scared half the country and made him a star and a popular star. It was at, it was only after War of the Worlds that they got a sponsor. They didn't have a sponsor before. The show was a sustaining show, meaning it was, the network paid for it.
And then it was Campbell Soup or
Campbell
something?
Campbell Soup. Yeah. It became the Campbell Playhouse. Yeah. Went from being the Mercury Theater on the air to the Campbell Playhouse.
Well, you know, you have an entire book of your interviews with Wells, and you have this book I mentioned, Who the Devil Made It, your interviews with directors. What did you learn from interviewing directors that you didn't learn from watching their films?
Oh, wow, a lot. I mean, learned a lot. A lot of things that I use all the time, just talking to them and getting to know them, seeing them working. Things about geography in movies, how you can create your own geography. I learned from Howard Hawks, or how it's not a good idea to rehearse action, how it's not a good idea to rehearse dramatic scenes.
You don't rehearse when you...
Not a dramatic scene, not a big dramatic scene like the end of a picture show. Or
how do you... You just start the cameras rolling?
You just say, do it.
Yeah.
Because if it's a big and dramatic scene, a person has to cry and yell and all that. You don't want to waste it doing a rehearsal. Because it's the first time they do it is what's going to be the best time they do it. If they're any good, they're probably going to do it best right away.
So you just trust you've got the right actor to do it.
Yeah, and you don't do it first thing. You don't do it early on in the shoot.
Hitchcock didn't like to talk to his actors or tell them anything. Are you the same? Or?
That's not true.
No?
He liked to say that, but I saw him directing actors.
One of my guests here had done a biography of Doris Day, and he said that Doris was very upset while making The Man Who Knew Too Much that he hadn't told her anything. She said, "Don't you like what I'm doing?" He said, "If I didn't like it, I would have said something." Or something.
Yeah. Yeah, that's often true. Is praised by through silence.
Uh-huh.
Hitch wasn't garrulous with the actors, but he did direct them, and he had a kind of a pretty pleasant mood on the set. I watched him direct with the Birds.
Oh, yeah?
For a few days, and he was fun to be around on the set. I watched him direct Topaz, which he didn't like particularly, but he was into it.
It's an interesting film, Topaz. I like it a lot. It's kind of a movie about color.
Yeah. I watched him direct Torn Curtain, too.
Oh, uh-huh.
He did not get along with Paul. He didn't get along with Paul.
That has at least one great scene. But that's also the film we had his falling out with Bernard Herrmann, right?
Yeah.
What happened there, do you know?
Hitch wanted not a dark score, and Benny Herrmann wrote a dark score, and Hitch got furious.
Hmm.
But I think he didn't like the picture, and he was worried about it.
Yeah.
And he wanted to have a score that was counterpoint to the movie, but, you know, it wasn't a good score he ended up with.
No.
Wasn't a great score.
There's a few scenes that have no score at all, though you really would think, oh, a Bernard Herrmann score would be great here.
Yeah.
You said in your book, I'm not sure which book, so forgive me, but you said in one of your books that you think the years 1912 to 1962 were the great years of American movies. It's been almost 50 years since then. Do you think there are any films in the last 50 years that you would consider classics?
Oh, I think there have been many. I mean, I don't know about many, but there have been a number of really good films made since then. I didn't mean to say it ended. It was the end of the whole thing. I think people have made some good films, but... as an era, the classic golden era, age of American movies was then. I mean, everything was invented then. Everything was done then. They did things through implication rather than explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
The best comedies were made at that period. You had the most number of stars.
Yeah.
You had great character actors. I mean, it was golden age. I mean, there were crappy movies made at that period, too. And some of the crappy movies were popular and won Oscars. But still, Well, so what else is new?
Well, do you still go to the movies, or do you watch them?
Not much. I go occasionally when I hear something's good, or if I have a friend who made a picture, or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm not drawn to see pictures. They're very disappointing.
What's wrong with them?
Well, they don't seem to have much of a personality. A lot of movies are made, they look mechanical. And that's because they are. You know, one of the things, I interviewed 16 directors for that director's book, and then there was Orson Welles and John Ford, that's 18, and then I interviewed a lot of directors whom I didn't record, like Sammy Fuller or Jean Renoir. I mean, I got to know them, and we talked a lot, or Bud Bedeker and so on. And one, the thing that all of them, the one thing that all the directors I interviewed had in common was their pride in doing things for a price and being able to cut corners and shoot just what they needed and only shoot what they needed and not shoot any extraneous stuff. That was what they all had great pride in that, whether it was, you know, Otto Preminger or Hitchcock or Howard Hawks, mm-hmm. or Ford or Orson. That's all gone by the by. I mean, everybody shoots everything.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason pictures cost so much a lot of the time is because the director shoots everything in sight and then makes his decision in the cutting room. To me, that's not directing.
It's editing.
It's editing, and it's making the picture in the cutting room. I like to make the picture on the set with the actors. That's when you. That's when I think you should make the picture.
Well, Bud Bedeker never made a movie that was, you know, longer than 75 minutes. Do you think the movies are too long now?
Well, you know, you see a movie that these days, and you say, "Where's Raoul Walsh when we need him?" Because Raoul could tell a story, you know, in no time at all, and it would be more interesting.
Yeah. You say you do. You agree that movies are too long now.
Too long, and there's a kind of MTV editing style that now exists where...
They don't hold a shot for very long.
No, you'd be lucky to see a shot that's held for more than 5-6 seconds. And somebody noticed the other day, I was talking to somebody, noticed that there's a lot of sustained scenes in Touch of Evil.
Yeah.
He said, was that common? I said, well, you know, in the golden age of movies, a lot of directors sustained scenes, particularly in the talking era, because people like Renoir realized that performances are better when they're not interrupted. So there were always long takes in movies. You just don't notice them. And then there was quick cutting also when necessary, but now it's just quick cutting all the time, when it's necessary, when it's not necessary, just constant. And that's how movies are made now. Cut. It's Gary, there's nothing easier than to do that. It's the easiest way to make a movie. Shoot every angle you can shoot and then make the decision in the editing room and glue it all together with music.
Oh, do you think it's that people have shorter attention spans now?
No, it had nothing to do with the audience. Has to do with the decadence of the filmmaking process.
Well, do you think if somebody tried to make Citizen Kane or Touch of Evil with those long scenes, people, the producers would say, you can't have it. That's going to put us all to sleep.
I don't know. I've never had any... I mean, I shoot long takes in pictures, and I've never had anybody argue about it. I've done it on TV where they interfere and... They never gave me any trouble about it.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is KSCO. It's From the Bookshelf. And this week, we're listening back to my 2009 interview with film director Peter Bogdanovich, who died on January 6th at the age of 82.
A lot of your recent films have been television films, although you do both theatrical and television films. Did the Tom Petty movie play in theaters, or was it?
Briefly, one night only in about 30 markets, and then another night only in about 30 other markets.
How did you feel about that film?
I loved it. I thought it was really cool. I enjoyed making it, and it took me 2 years.
Yeah.
Part of the reason was because I enjoyed hanging with the band. I just enjoyed doing it. It plays very well on the big screen, that film.
Yeah. I love it. I think it's great. I didn't see it in the theater, but...
Well, it plays great in theaters, but it plays fine on the TV, too.
I have a big TV.
Yeah, it's great sound.
Yeah. What are you working on now? You have a film you're in production on now?
Not in production, but we're veering in that direction with a couple of films. I have about four films that we're sort of in various stages of preparation on. I don't know which one will go first.
Yeah.
I've got a kind of a modern Western, and I've got an Alzheimer's love story, and I've got a ghost picture, and I've got a screwball comedy. They're all sort of on the burner.
And are these pictures, do you feel that these are movies that you've generated, or they're movies that have come to you, or what?
The first two I mentioned, the love story and the kind of modern Western, came to me, and I rewrote them. And the other two are self-generated.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about a film of yours that I like a lot, which was The Cat's Meow.
Yeah.
Were you happy with that film?
Yeah, I thought it came out well.
That film, and also the movie you made for TV about Natalie Wood, both have deaths that were mysterious or unexplained, but you take a specific point of view in both films. How'd you decide to do that? Especially the one with Thomas Ince, where it's certainly been up in the air for, 50 years or something?
Well, if you're going to tell a story like that, if you're going to tell it at all, you better tell him what happened, or at least show him a version of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just say, well, we don't know what happened. Then don't make the movie. I mean, I think you have to sort of take a point of view.
And so do you think that your point of view in The Cat's Meow is accurate?
Well, it seemed to make sense, you know. There's no way to know. We'll never know the truth. But it seemed to make sense with what everybody, with all the testimony that was available.
Did you ever discuss that with any of the principals?
No, they're all gone.
Right, but, you know, you've met some of them, no? Did you ever meet Chaplin?
Just Chaplin, but I mean, by the time I met Charlie, he wasn't in really good shape. He didn't remember much.
Yeah.
He never would have talked about that incident anyway. He claimed he wasn't even on the ship.
Huh. And you have an affection for that era. Nickelodeon is another one of your films that I love that, I don't know, might not have been a big hit, but it's one of my favorites. Do you like silent films? Do you still?
I like silent films. You know, not all silent films. Most of them were junk, but there was a lot of good ones. I love the. It's a whole different thing than talking pictures. But the great moments, film directors who began in the silent era, and then subsequently did sound pictures. Their greatest moments are usually silent in the pictures. Very interesting.
In other words, they make talking pictures, but they have silent sequences.
Silent sequences that are the most memorable. Because it is, after all, a visual medium, which we've forgotten now. By visual medium now, we mean just a lot of quick cutting. But Nickelodeon, by the way, is coming out on DVD for the first time in America on the 21st, in a box set with The Last Picture Show.
Oh, fantastic.
And I wasn't as keen on Nickelodeon, particularly because there was some stuff cut out, and I wanted it to be in black and white. So the new set, the new edition includes the released version in color and a black and white version that the director wanted.
Oh, fantastic. So we'll see a little bit closer to the version that you wanted.
Yeah, it was compromised a bit in casting, so it'll never be what I wanted, but it's much closer in the black and white.
Who did you want? Can you say who you wanted?
Well, I wanted a younger cast. I wanted to use Jeff Bridges and John Ritter.
Mm.
Jeff to play the Burt Reynolds part and John Ritter to play the Ryan O'Neill part.
So Burt Reynolds was imposed on you?
No, I picked him because I had to choose a star.
Yeah.
So I picked two stars that I'd worked with.
What about St. Jack? Any thoughts about that film?
St. Jack came out the way I wanted it to. That was one of my better pictures, I think. I'm very pleased with that film. It sort of screwed up my life there for a while.
Why did it screw
up? Well,
your life?
You know, there are life-altering movies, and that was one of them. Oh, just my relationship with Sybil fell apart. I was gone for 6 months in Singapore and having a great time.
Uh-huh. There was some great acting in St. Jack.
Yeah, Ben Gazzara was amazing, and so was Denham Elliott. They were both great. They were great together. Two really, 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 really good actors, as good as they get.
I think it's the best thing that Ben Gazzara did in his career so far.
He thinks so. And, it's his favorite film. We loved doing it together. We both had a great time. And it was really a collaboration. I mean, I wrote it for... I wanted to do it with Benny, and when I wrote the script, it was for him, just like They All Laughed was. I think really St. Jack and They All Laughed was a high point for me. Those two pictures, that point, that place in my career was very, very strong. Pinnacle.
Well, can you explain why those films aren't as well remembered or received at the time?
Well, they weren't really released very well. I mean, St. Jack was released by Roger Corman and sort of not very aggressively, and he didn't spend any money. It got good reviews.
Mm-hmm.
By and large, I mean, the Times didn't get it, but Vincent Canby saw he was drunk and slept through the whole picture. When they woke him up to tell him it was over, he said, "Oh, it's like an Alan Ladd movie." I mean, he just didn't know what he was doing.
Uh-huh.
But Jack Kroll and Newsweek got it, and it got some good reviews. And I think it's one of my best pictures. A lot of filmmakers like it.
And They All Laughed.
Like Wes Anderson and Quentin Tarantino. I mean, they really dig it.
Oh yeah, I wanted to ask you about Tarantino. He gives you sort of special thanks in Kill Bill, I think it is.
Yeah, I can tell you about that. They All Laughed. That's my favorite picture of all the films I've ever made.
Why?
Well, if you said to me, of all the movies you've made, which one is the most like you? Which one is the most personal? I'd say They All Laughed. It deals with serious subject lightly. It has a combination of comedy and drama. It's elegiac without playing the violins too loud. It's set in New York, which is my hometown. I loved the actresses in it, all of them. And the actors. I mean, John Ritter was one of my favorite people in the world.
Mm-hmm. Audrey Hepburn is great,
and Audrey's wonderful, and Dorothy was, I was in love with Dorothy, and just, it was a great period.
That's a wonderful film. So, Tarantino, yeah, he gives you special thanks. What did you do to earn your his thanks?
Oh, you know, Quentin is such a movie buff. He noticed that in my films, if there's a, generally speaking, if there's a news broadcast or a disc jockey, that it's me doing it. I'm either the disc jockey or the newscaster in Picture Show and Paper Moon and a few other pictures. So Quentin realized that. And he, when he was doing Kill Bill, he used some of my voice as a disc jockey in some of the scenes.
Did he get you to record it, or he stole
he
it from
did it. He used it from the movie originally, and then he called me and said, "I want to get it clean. Can you come in and do it?" I said, "Sure." I thought it was funny, so I came in and did it. And he directed me for an hour or so and enjoyed himself, and we had fun. We're friends anyway, and then he unnecessarily gave me credit, which was really just, I just did it as a joke, kind of.
Do you enjoy acting?
Oh, yeah, acting's fun.
Well, you recently did The Sopranos. That was probably your most visible part in a long time.
Yeah, well, that was the great, amazing role that I had. An amazing part of an amazing series. That was just phenomenal.
You were great in it.
Thank you. I enjoyed doing it. It was a wonderful part. He was so square and sort of essentially decent. And then at the end, he does that strange thing and gives out the information to who she's with. It was interesting.
Yeah. And you were in, I don't know, you did 10 or 11 episodes of it?
I don't know. I never counted. I think it was more like 15.
Mm-hmm. And would you do that again, a recurring role in a series?
Oh, yes, in a heartbeat.
Which of the directors, you know, your contemporaries, are you friendly with? And
I'm sort of friendly with, you mean the kids?
Yeah.
Or my contemporaries. Not that friendly with any of my contemporaries, but the younger people, I'm quite friendly with Wes Anderson and Noah Baumbach. They both call me, I allow them to call me Pop, and I call them Son.
But you're the kid, aren't you?
Huh?
Aren't you the kid, director?
Yeah, I was the kid once. And Quentin.
Uh-huh.
Those three are quite friendly. And I know others, Rick Linklater is a friend and so on, but I don't hang with him much.
Do you think you have masterworks yet to make?
Well, that's interesting. I have a picture I've been working on honing, well, I don't know how many years it's been. I suppose it's been about 29 years that I first had the idea about 28, 29 years ago. And I worked on it for about 13 years without realizing I didn't have a third act.
Hmm.
And then I realized I didn't have a third act, so I spent another few years trying to figure out how to make it work. This is all between other projects. And I had had two different titles, and let me say, it started out as about a director who has had three wives and three daughters, and it all played in Paris. Now it's about a director who had six wives and six daughters and plays in five countries, all in about 4 days.
Huh.
It's the best thing I ever conceived. It's called Wait For Me.
Wait For Me. And when? How much longer do we have to wait for Wait For Me?
Well, I've got somebody who's very interested in putting it together with me. It just happened the last few days, so hopefully soon. It's a magnum opus. It's not an easy picture to make. It's got a lot of special effects. It's not like anything I've ever done. It's a fantasy. It's got six ghosts in it, and it's set in Rome, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, and Salzburg.
Do you have a cast in mind?
It's a huge cast. That's the problem.
Uh-huh.
Because there are six wives and six daughters, and you meet them all, and then there's six friends and assorted other people. So there's a lot of people in it.
But that's the kind of thing you would want to use stars for, right? Because you'd want to be able to keep them straight.
Well, that's exactly right, Gary. That is the plan, is to use name actors for all the leading roles.
Yeah.
But I haven't zeroed in on who we... It was originally written, but he died before I could get to a real good draft. It was originally written with John Cassavetes in mind, but mm-hmm. And John loved the idea and kept telling me to do it, and I said, well, I haven't got it right yet.
I'm available, by the way.
Okay. It's good to know.
Well, I'm looking forward to that picture.
Me too.
What will be the next thing that will have your name on it that we'll see?
Gary, if I knew that, I'd be clairvoyant. I don't know, but it'll be probably one of the four I mentioned, or it might be something I don't even know about.
That hasn't come your way.
That's what show business is like. But there are four scripts that are at the moment have my attention. One is a Western, which is called One Lucky Moon, and then there's a kind of a love story, a tragic love story called I'll Remember April.
Have you actually ever done a Western before?
No, except for The Lonesome Dove, which I did in my head.
Mm-hmm.
But it was called Streets of Laredo. And then there's a comedy, a kind of real wild screwball comedy set in New York called Squirrels to the Nuts, which is I love, and I'll hopefully do that. And Wait For Me.
Wait For Me. That's going to be the masterpiece that you've...
Well, I don't know about masterpiece, but it's an important picture for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of your favorite directors worked, you know, until they were old men.
Practically dead.
Yeah. Do you plan on doing the same?
Well, I think people are older and younger today at the same time. I think, you know, I think when John Ford was my age, he was a pretty old man.
Right. But people live longer now.
Well, also they take better care of themselves because they know that cigarettes and cigars kill you.
You're very fit, I mean, as opposed to your Orson Welles, you know?
Yeah, well, yeah.
He was like seven times your size.
Well, my mentors are like Orson or Hitch or Ford. They didn't take very good care of themselves.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us, Peter Bogdanovich. It's really an honor, a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, Gary. It's nice to be on.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.